I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Ellen Morris Bond. She is with Self Help Inc. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be back.
It's been a while.
Yes, it has, some years.
What's Self Help Inc. about?
Self Help Inc. is an organization that's been around since 1969. And it is an organization that helps people in need all over northern New Mexico. Our ultimate goal is to enhance sustainability of families and economies in northern New Mexico. And we do that one person at a time, one family at a time, by responding to very specific needs they might have. Sometimes there are emergencies such as homelessness or utility shutoffs. Sometimes they are legal issues, a newly divorced single mom trying to figure out how to wend her way through the system. But in general, we consult with people and try to help them get all the resources they need to move to the next place in life.
I mean, the name sounds like that classic give them a fish, they'll eat for the day, learn to teach them to fish. So how are you teaching them to fish?
Well, we have a number of ways we do that. First of all, by helping with problem solving, helping think through a problem logically. What are the steps that need to be taken to resolve the problem? And then on more of a long-term basis, we teach financial literacy classes, and sometimes we'll do ongoing case management. For instance, there's a man who was living in his tent with a cat, and he came to my office one day, and it was really getting cold. So through various avenues, he's now in an apartment. He and his cat are just cozy. They have a housing voucher. He is getting Social Security disability pretty soon for his disabling condition. And we consider those sorts of things success stories, to move someone from a really difficult situation to what's relatively a success. He's also working for his landlord and feeling productive. So,
you must see more than most of us the holes in the so-called safety net.
Yes, they do need some sewing up. Particularly now, I'm meeting more highly educated people who are finding themselves without resources. I had a call from a guy the other day who actually had been working on his MBA when things fell apart for him economically. His job suddenly ended, and he was living in a hotel room trying to figure out his next move. And this is a highly educated person, very articulate. So we worked on some strategies, some job searches, went on the internet over the phone together, and talked about some avenues he might take to get plugged in, back into the job market.
And is there an outcome to that story yet?
The outcome is unknown. I'm hoping he will call me with good news, but he's not been reachable. A lot of my clients are, it's a little difficult to follow up with them because they're transient.
Yeah.
And moving from place to place, their phones lose minutes. Sometimes it's hard to reach them afterwards, but I'm always happy when there is a resolution and a success story.
How much of what you do involves teaching people to navigate the intricacies of the bureaucracies that are there to supposedly help them?
Well, a lot, actually. For instance, if a person has a long-term disability, I think particularly mental illness is the most difficult one. They really need a bit of hand-holding to get through the Social Security system, and at times we've sat down with them, helped them fill out the forms, and even gone with them to the Social Security office to do the final stage of getting a disability payment each month. These days, at least people can get food very easily. The food stamp laws have changed so that anyone who meets the criteria immediately gets food, and I feel good about that change. There have been some other more difficult changes. Immigrants, for instance, have more difficulty accessing health care and basic, getting their basic needs met. And we try to address that, actually. We're a bilingual office. We do some translating, and we try to help people with immigration issues whenever possible.
We're talking to Ellen Morris Bond of Self Help, Inc. What other programs do you have that you want to tell us about at Self Help, Inc.?
The two that I am really pleased with are that I wanted to talk about just for a minute are the Tools for Schools program, in which we distribute school supplies, new school supplies, to children in need all over northern New Mexico. And the other program is the Seed Money for Self-Reliance grants. We give out 3 to 5 grants per year for people who are trying to attain sustainability, economically speaking, such as someone who has a bakery who's trying to produce more by buying some more equipment. And these are very small amounts and small businesses, but we feel that these small grants have a powerful impact.
When you look at the whole big picture and the people who are coming to you and the people whom you serve, and then you think about the New Mexico public education system ranked somewhere between 48th and 49th in the nation, some, you know, by different studies or whatever, I mean, we're not in good shape. Let's say we had a first-rate education system here. How much would the need that you're seeing, do you think, be really met? Would it would go away?
Well, it wouldn't totally go away, because we'll always have people who have basic needs who do not have a voice and are not able to voice their needs. But I think if we did have a first-rate education system, we would see people more prepared for the workplace. We would see people with better writing skills, better math skills, the understanding of what's expected at a workplace.
And decision-making skills.
And decision-making skills are key. I meet so many people who are in struggle because along the way they've had some choices to make, and they've made some tough choices, maybe not to their own benefit, but it's led down a difficult road, and sometimes they end up homeless. But as I say, even educated people right now are struggling. There can be a series of events that cause them to struggle. But if we did have a first-rate education system, more of our 20-year-olds would be in the workforce. I really think so.
We are being joined right now by Eric Whittemore and Meredith Gill, who are from Bullseye Glass. And this is all about a fundraiser that you, Ellen Morris Bond, at Self Help, Inc., have put together. Tell us what the motivation was for this.
Well, this is the 19th annual Empty Bowl fundraiser. It'll be at the Betty Hart Senior Center in Los Alamos on St. Patrick's Day from 11 to 2. And this event is an event that happens all across the nation. People buy a clay bowl for $10. They have lunch, dessert, bread, and live music. And it's really a wonderful time together. And part of what produces this fundraiser is artists and others providing bowls.
Now, the bowls that I'm looking at a bowl right here on the table, a beautiful green glass bowl from Bullseye Glass. Meredith and Eric, tell us about Bullseye and about your participation in this event with Self-Help.
Well, Bullseye has been a glass company based out of Portland, Oregon, since the mid-70s. And they have always made it a point as a company to provide the time for their employees, but also the will of the company at times to support various benefits here and there. A lot of the employees in Portland do outreach. And we have actually, for a number of years, designed bowls for this same very event that's going on in Portland as well as other cities across the U.S. as well. So it's something that is kind of part of the founding of the company and trying to really get out and help the community that we're in. So it's great that this opportunity has come up so quickly with us only being down here for about 2 years now. So we're really excited about it and really excited to see what everyone does with those bowls.
So people are going to be able to design a bowl, a glass bowl, make a glass bowl? How does that work?
What we're going to do when we're designing these bowls is we have some pre-cut parts and pieces, so we can cut down on the amount of time that the students coming in or the people that are coming in to support this benefit will have to spend in learning how to use the material right off the bat, those kind of things. But we'll start off with glass, very similar to what you would think of in terms of stained glass. But we've designed and made that glass in a way that it will actually be fused together. And we'll build that up in a few layers of glass, add some designs on the top surface and some other glass materials. And that gets actually heated in a kiln or a high-temperature oven to temperatures around 1,500 degrees. We then take that back out, and then that'll be slumped in a subsequent firing so that it gives it the shape. So it starts
slumped
off flat.
Slumped means making it from a flat piece into a bowl thing.
Exactly. And we can actually slump that into a variety of forms, but we've chosen a soup bowl specifically for this because, obviously, soup is going to be served in that.
Right.
But a variety of forms can come out from that.
Now, Meredith, you're a glass artist?
Yeah, I've worked in the glass medium for a while now. I went to school focusing in glass art. Been doing it for about 10 years now. Started out just, you know, doing it in college and then worked with a bunch of different artists around, I guess, the world. And it worked out for a great while until I actually got this great opportunity here in Santa Fe to work for the Bullseye Glass Company. So this is just a fantastic event that we're going to be doing here. Actually, my mother works with Ellen over at Self Help, and she came to me asking if maybe we could set up some sort of situation where we could make these glass bowls and donate them. And that's actually where we've come up with this idea to design a benefit bowl and have an event surrounding it.
So the event is Saturday, the 25th of February from 1 to 3. And it's at 805 Early Street, Building E. That's not far from the Santa Fe Baking Company, and that's
right.
Where Bullseye Glass is. And so people can just show up. And if you want more information, you can call 467-8951. That's in the 505 area code. And 505-467-8951.
You can also swing by the store and see what the bowls look like, and then we can tell you a little bit more about it in person and can fill you in and get you into the benefit going on Saturday the 25th.
So Saturday the 25th is Design a Bowl, and then St. Patrick's Day is the Empty Bowls fundraiser silent auction. So there's two
exactly.
different events.
Exactly.
Just to be clear.
And
where's the one on St. Patrick's Day?
It's at the Betty E. Hart Senior Center.
Oh, that's right. You said
in
that.
Los Alamos. And I just wanted to say the website is selfhelpla.org.
Selfhelpla.org.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Ellen Morris Bond, Eric Whittemore, and Meredith Gill on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are talking now to two of the gender offenders, Peter Quince, the carpenter, and Johnny Cunningham. And the gender offenders are presenting a performance called Dirty, a queer mashup of ridiculous hotness, including drag, burlesque, circus, and other brave sex-positive theatrics. And that is on Friday and Saturday of this week at the Moving People Dance Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So this is the gender offenders. It's basically, as you told me before the radio show, it's not just like the male or female gender. It's kind of all genders.
Yeah, it's queer gender.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, we understand queerness is the full rainbow of gender expression and sexuality. It's inherently sex positive, body positive, and it's revolutionary in the face of convention and oppression. Queer performance itself is also revolutionary because it tosses out all the conventions and breaks any rules of first, of course, heterosexual gender, but also queering all standards for drag. It opens the windows to let the rainbow shine, and we open our throats to shout and make sweet song, belt out our truths, pretty and also very, very dirty. So we're going to just put our dirtiest dreams on a platter, and it will be delicious.
Serve them right up.
I just learned today that, before I was talking to you guys, that drag comes from like an 18th century expression that referred to men's skirts dragging on the ground. What is drag, which I thought was hilarious. What is drag to you guys?
That is hilarious.
Drag to me is the opportunity to perform a gender that I feel is more masculine to me than what I might be in the rest of my life. I feel like the opportunity to perform drag is to get out and, you know, it can be in the way you move, in the way you put on your clothes, you can pack, you can change the way your body looks, but it's mostly about, you know, showing that whatever my body is, I can put on this gender, and it's surprising to people.
Mm-hmm. I always wonder, I mean, it seems like sometimes in drag, like if you have a man playing a woman, he will do the most stereotypically super femme things, which, and I wonder, does that like break down gender or does it reinforce it?
Well, I think that it does both of those things. And I think that it, the intention of the performer can be so like so strong that it will leave the audience questioning those things. Something mm-hmm. so over the top and so silly, it'll just plant that seed in your mind. Like, how silly is this? The whole notion is so, you know.
Right. Well, the fact that gender is something that is performed
all
you
the
know,
time, every
all the
day.
Time.
What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's the great author Kate Bornstein says gender is something you put on when you get dressed in the morning. So you know, we all have. And are witness to in the products of our society telling us this is, you know, if you have this kind of body, this is what you look like as a guy, and this is what you're supposed to be wearing if you, you know, want to be a woman, this is how you're supposed to behave. But when you break it down, it's like individual choice, and we can do whatever we want.
We can queer our gender
yeah.
any minute, any day, any way.
And it's individual choice. It's also really inclination. Like, I sometimes watch 9-year-old girls who are so super, super girly. And they're not, I mean, yeah, maybe some of it is socialization, but they just, like, that's who they are. And then another 9-year-old girl is just a pure tomboy, and she's out there doing it. And it's sort of like, leave them alone to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, sometimes I think girls have more freedom than boys to kind of be anywhere they feel like along that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think it's like, if you really, it's deep stuff. It's deep stuff. You got to learn and read. And I'm still in the process of, you know, getting myself educated about and to break down some of the just stereotypes of what is masculine and what's acceptable from a man or a woman and people perceived as the in-betweens. And I think that you can.
Blur those boundaries.
You can blur those boundaries,
any
exactly.
Any way you want, and that is part of that revolutionary expression.
Right.
All the time.
And then it's really powerful for people to see that on stage. It's really powerful to perform it and to work against all the mainstream representations that we're constantly inundated with.
Mm-hmm.
It's really radical, I think, to get on stage and do drag mm-hmm. for that very reason, especially, you know, being drag kings. And we really... Like, it's part of our mission to stay away from, you know, misogyny or the, you know, to be reinforcing any stereotypes that further the oppression of men or women. And
also and any form anybody. Of oppression whatsoever. Cultural appropriation, cultural expression is very important as well, because all oppression is interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are really trying to empower our community as our audience to be silly and sexy and just make questions.
Mm-hmm.
Any standard that people are putting in front of you, is make a question about it, you know? And like, because it is just, it's all silly.
Tell us about the actual performance. Like, what will we maybe see?
Well.
Singing? Dancing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're going to see some live singing. You're going to see some circus. You're going to see some pretty hot drag acts. You're going to see some dance. And you're going to even see some Shakespeare, which we have been calling Shakesqueer internally. But, yeah, and it's going to be – I mean, we really have collaborated a lot. I mean, the Gender Offenders are a communal group that has just, you know – put together all of our best intentions in this show. We've got, like, there's going to be lots of treats, some delicious foods, and we're going to have a craft table that you can buy some awesome merch from some of our performers. And, yeah.
And if I may ask a sort of gender question, do you have both drag queens and drag kings, so to speak, in the performance?
That and more, honestly.
That and more, yeah.
It's beyond even the two, you know? Always beyond the two. So it's
yeah, I'd agree.
Okay, mm-hmm. so we will wait to be surprised. What kind of audiences do you get? Do you get kind of like what might be called the queer community, or do you kind of, has it broadened out to kind of everybody, general audience?
Well, the show that we did last year at Moving People was sold out both nights, and we were so thrilled to have that happen. And so it seems to me that Santa Fe is definitely supporting us as a community. We're a community of queer folks, but we have a lot of allies as well, and we're so grateful for the support of everyone in Santa Fe and Albuquerque and all of New Mexico that support us.
Yeah, and I would say that even to people who don't identify as queer and who may identify as straight, I think it's like it's pure pleasure when you walk into the show. I think like this year it will be especially so, and that people from, you know, no matter who you are, like seeing somebody get on stage, seeing a group of people get on stage and be really honest, really courageous, really bring
and
something
really
from their heart,
sexy.
And really sexy is just so appealing. To all of the above. So I think our network, especially, you know, with Facebook and people bringing friends, and, you know, we all have straight friends and stuff, and it builds and spreads and really reaches a diverse people.
Well, you know, and also, I mean, except for those of us who are doing what you guys are doing, which is really exploring this stuff in a creative and artistic way, I would say all of us have hidden sides of ourselves that we don't express that cross boundaries of gender. And to see somebody else doing that, no matter what your identification is kind of fun and liberating and mm-hmm. makes you kind of think about exploring yourself in other ways.
That's exactly what we want to be doing.
Yeah, we want people to come and, like, we want them to, you know, have a great time, first of all, you know, to, like, laugh and then, you know, get, sometimes, I think we've said before, laugh so hard you get turned on, you know, like, kind of surprise yourself. You're like, wow, I had no idea I would think that that is sexy. And I think that drag can really do that, kind of get in your head and, like, you know, just, like, and especially, like, variant gender expressions can, like, affect you in ways you never would have guessed. And it is, like, it is surprising and refreshing.
I suppose the one time that people do that sometimes is on Halloween. They dress up as something completely different.
It's like their excuse. Mm-hmm.
And they get to act as something different. And it is in fact, liberating. It can sometimes mess with your head.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, costume and performance, I mean, it does that, you know? You get to try something on for size. And, you know, you get to perform this thing that maybe is, like, you know, too hidden or too forbidden. And the dirty concept has, like, was this gateway for us to bring up all those things beneath the surface that you might want to just kind of keep hush-hush.
The world has changed. We're talking to the gender offenders, Peter Quince the Carpenter and Johnny Cunningham. And I think something that has changed a lot since, let's say, Stonewall, which was, what, 40-something years ago, is there is, I think, a lot more freedom to be whatever you are and express yourself in whatever way you want. There's also a long way to go. But when you think about oppression and when you think about a community like Santa Fe and what's going on in your own lives, what you've experienced yourself, where are we at? How much longer do we have to go? I mean, have you guys been, guys, gals, whatever you are, have been what you might think of as hassled for being how you are, expressing yourself the way you do?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's been a struggle in my life around that, you know? And I think that,
what does that look like?
It looks like the face of oppression in all people's lives. I think that I feel like a terrible amount of compassion and interconnectedness with oppression as it manifests in everyone's lives.
I mean, do people say things to you that are obnoxious?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
And it is what it is. I think it's really interesting that you brought up Stonewall, because Stonewall was an amazing moment and it is considered the kickstart of the gay rights movement, right? It's when the queer bars were completely illegal in New York City and the police came in and busted them. They were mafia run, and anyone who wasn't wearing 3 articles of clothing that belonged to their assigned gender would be arrested and brought in the paddy wagon.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, one night, the night that Judy Garland had passed away in 1969, there was an uproar. And who fought back was the people of color, the drag queens, going down the street in their can-can lines, throwing high heels at the police. And so from its root, Stonewall is just a beautiful, beautiful beacon for me as a queer person to recognize that the strength of the movement comes from the margins. Like, queerness is not about assimilation, it is about revolution in the face mm-hmm. of convention and oppression, and is inherently so. And so I am deeply, deeply inspired by that, and it's dirty.
Amen.
Quince.
How do you envision the world that you would like to live in?
I envision a world where people are really, like, celebrated for their uniqueness, you know, on the topic of gender, whatever gender that is, you know, their unique way of expressing themselves and their ideas. One of my dear friends uses the word magical to describe mm-hmm. people, that we're all magical, and I envision a world where that is seen and respected and, you know, cultivated.
Absolutely.
I guess, and, like, you know, we just realize how special it is that we're all so different like that in terms yeah. of our gender, in terms of our sexuality, in terms of how we express ourselves and what we want to put out there and, you know, all our ideas.
And that there is no norm. There's no one standard of normal that everybody either is in line with or deviates with. If there's anything that I've learned from both the Kinsey studies and Dan Savage in his weekly column that we read here in The Reporter, is that we are all just different.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. that's kind of the norm.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, I think norm in the sociological sense will always, like, in some ways exist. That, or as long as, oh, mainstream, like, media and stuff like that always puts out a norm. They like to have a norm. A
but
right,
it's
wrong.
False.
But it is contrived and...
It's quite lucrative, though.
Right.
I might add.
How's that?
Right.
Makes money.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how?
Well, if we're showing you that this is what, you know, a successful man looks like and, you know, watching that, well, we all want to be successful.
Yeah, it gives us standards to vie for as consumers,
right.
You know.
It's
like
right. Oh, okay. And so the norm is like... 25-year-old woman with perfect hair and skin and
right and like
and
married with children and,
right.
and has a house and like has a certain, you know, material mm-hmm. existence that we deem as successful, and those are prioritized more over like community and her
but you know
expression.
what sometimes she even has some dirty thoughts in her mind when
right
she goes to bed
exactly
in the
no.
morning.
We all do. We yeah. all do. We mm-hmm. we all question. We question ourselves. We question our relationships. I think that most people ask, like, at some point, in many points of life, like, what am I actually doing? You know, because it's really easy to get caught up in pursuing this image of success. And, you know, but even those who, like, have the picture perfect are questioning, you know, maybe they have some desires that they question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have some attractions they question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have some real radical thoughts and, you know, that don't align with the political views of, you know, their peers. We question all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Quince the Carpenter and Johnny Cunningham are part of the ensemble called The Gender Offenders, and this weekend they are presenting Dirty, a queer mashup of ridiculous hotness, including drag, burlesque, circus, and other brave sex-positive theatrics. I love your title. It's fabulous. And that's Friday and Saturday at 7:30 at Moving People Dance Center, which is at 1583 Pacheco Street here in Santa Fe. And the tickets are on a sliding scale, and no one is turned away for lack of funds. You can get your tickets at the door. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Greg Opstad, Michael G. Smith, and Mary Strong Jackson. They are all poets who have contributed to the volume called Liberty's Vigil, the Occupy Anthology. It's 99 poets among the 99%. And they will be taking part in a reading called Occupy with Poetry tomorrow, Wednesday, the 22nd of February, from 6 to 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, that will be at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe in the Sambusco Shopping Center. So let's talk about this book. It's it's bound with string. It's a book of poetry from, I guess, all over the United States, published by Foothills Publishing. How did this come together?
There are two editors. The main editor, Carla Lynn Merrifield, who's a New York State poet, had the idea to do this last fall. And she contacted the second editor, Dwayne Wilder, and he agreed to help. They contacted Foothills, and Foothills agreed to publish it. Then they just spammed.
99% of the United States of America?
And international. There's international contributions in here, too. I think 8 countries.
I wish they'd put in where everybody was from. You read these poems, and you don't know where anybody's from.
I think it's in the back.
Maybe. Oh, okay.
Yeah, the list of contributors is in the back, and sometimes it says where they're from. That depends on what the contributors wrote in their bios.
Oh, okay.
I think the call from submissions went out in different ways. I received it from the publisher because I've had some books published by Foothills Publishing. It's a little family-run publishing company in New York, and they hand-stitch the books themselves.
Yeah.
So that's very cool.
So it must be somewhat limited edition.
I think that they will keep making them as however many they need. You know, hopefully they'll sell a lot.
So there are poetry readings going on all over the country with the poets from this book reading. Are they all happening tomorrow? Is it like a simultaneous nationwide event?
No, it's been an ongoing. They've started as soon as the book was out, January 15th, and they're continuing, and they've just been in various places.
Would you like to, as a starting point, each read your contribution to this book?
Sure, that'd be nice.
Okay. Mary, do you want to start?
Sure. My poem comes from conversations with a homeless friend of mine, and it's called The New Homeless Rage. The world's gone pear-shaped, do you feel it? How did I get here, you ask, in this 2 degrees and once business-owning life of mine? 2, maybe 3 missteps. Now I sleep in a state park, scared of snapping sticks, grim reapers, wolves, and werewolves. Afraid to sleep, afraid to wake. Always the cold. Coming, going, staying. But my shivery spine comes from eyes that glaze when I tell my story. Don't worry, you'll find a job, they say, pat, pat. What don't you fucking get, I say. I can't stop crying, swearing, raging. I know what it is to flip the light switch in a house. Draw a bath, lie on Martha Stewart sheets, plant a lilac bush on Saturday, drink a latte on Sunday. It's gone. I am less. Homeless, moneyless, scared shitless. I tell the Tuesday soup kitchen lady thank you and ask what she does the other 6 days when the wolves are eating me. Does anyone get it?
And that's Mary Strong Jackson reading the poem from Liberty's Vigil, the Occupy anthology. Now, this is a true story of a friend of yours, and it's probably the true story of a lot of people.
It is. I'm a social worker as well as a poet and a freelance writer, and I'm working with a lot of what the people that are really, I guess, getting to me are the women my age that come in to where I work, and they spend hours on the computer looking for work, and they are women that had successful careers and find themselves in this desperate situation. So it's kind of shocking to me. And so, yes, this is exactly how she was feeling.
And it's, it's interesting. First of all, it's an obvious example of the total lack of safety net that we have in this country, that the woman in this poem and the others whom you meet literally don't have a place indoors to rest their head.
That's true. Some of them are in very desperate situations. Luckily, there are, we do have some homeless shelters here or a women's shelter, but that's also limited. You know, they can stay a few months, but then they have to move out because there's more that that need to move in, so they have to really work to find another place to go.
And these people are looking for jobs the whole time.
They are. It's not like they're just sitting around waiting for something good to happen, because they are just desperately, frantically looking for work.
Let's hear your poem, Greg Opstad.
Okay. Saying goodbye to the middle class. Switch to basic cable. Don't go out to eat as often. Eat peanut butter, ramen noodles. No trips to the mall, no summer vacation. Cancel the paper, drop the cable altogether. Don't even go out to McDonald's in the next round of cuts. Jeans at Goodwill are $3.99 a pair, shoes $5. Go to the emergency room if the kids really get sick. Buy the cheapest tires, the ones without a mileage guarantee. New ones on the front, the better of the worn ones in back. Change the oil, but wait on the brakes. Walk to the laundromat when the washer quits. Juggle the bills, this one this month, that one the next. You said you'd never do it, but the stuff you still can't cut goes on the card. Even without a raise, you are glad to have a job. They talk layoffs, and you don't sleep at night.
Now, is this a story of a particular person?
I've been talking to and listening basically to my adult children. They're in their late 30s, early 40s, and just within my own family, I'm seeing people slowly lose the footing that they had. Their jobs are not, prices are going up, their jobs are not paying the bills as well as they did, and they're gradually slipping further and further behind.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of how even living without what some people call necessities, I mean, if you think of television as a necessity or a luxury, some people think it's a wonderful thing to do without, but it gets down to the brakes on your car, which are not a luxury.
Right.
And when that starts to go, it shows how society begins to fall apart. At some point, somebody who didn't fix their brakes because they couldn't has an accident, and the social fabric is torn.
Gradually, I'm just seeing more and more people making that slide. Both people I know, you know, personally, and, you know, stories you hear on the news. People are just falling behind and not able to live up to the dream that we were lucky enough to experience.
Michael G. Smith, would you like to read your poem?
Yeah, gladly. Just as a little background, I took my 6-year-old niece to one of the Occupy marches, and so the poem is written from her perspective, from the discussions we had during and afterwards. My school needs playground equipment. I am 6 and do not understand some of the signs people hold, but I do understand mic check and all these happy people who want to be heard. Even people driving by honking and waving want to be heard. They wave and smile as me and Maita hold our handmade sign. Less military dollars, more social dollars. Except one who waved his middle finger. I think he needs to play more, like I pretend standing on the street today is sort of a game. Even though Maita explained, some people are afraid and play expensive, dangerous games where many people get hurt or killed. And the sun is shining, and all these happy people are talking and waving, and Maita talks to this person and that person, then explains to me what they talked about. But I want the angry man to be happy and feel safe. But before I can ask if he will buy a chocolate bar to help my school get swings and a slide,
He could play on two. He drives away.
And that was Michael J. Smith from the Occupy anthology. Now, it's interesting, you also have written a poem based on the experience of somebody close to you, in this case, a child.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really pretty much your poetic transcription of her experience?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we talked quite a bit about how money gets spent in this country. One of my major concerns is the amount of money that is spent on so-called defense.
So-called defense.
Yeah, it's offense. It's not defense. And it's offensive. 50% of the discretionary federal budget goes towards defense, which is seven times the total amount spent by the rest of the world on defense. So the fact that, you know, we're spending all this and our children can't even get slides at their schools,
right.
Something's really out of balance. And the way I see it is, you know, we could be taking a good chunk of this money and putting it towards education, energy sustainability, things like this, things that really make a difference.
This is such an interesting set of three poems that the three of you have read, because it speaks in a little microcosm, three little microcosms, of what society looks like when you have tremendous inequality. These are three examples of what it looks like, and they all have to do with the breakdown of the system and the inability of ordinary people to live ordinary, what we have constructed as ordinary lives, which in a country as rich as this, I think a lot of people think should be something that we can expect.
Right, yeah. And, you know, it's going beyond, it includes other issues too, like healthcare, right? 50 million Americans approximately don't have health insurance. And
many more who do have inadequate health insurance and still go broke.
Right. And people put off going to the doctor until the problem becomes almost catastrophic.
It's the same thing like fixing your brakes. Something bad is eventually going to happen.
Right. Even fire stations are closing and public schools are underfunded. It's, how can this be happening, you know? It's just almost unbelievable what is slowly, just like Greg said, just a gradual decline. You know, my coworkers were saying the other day, they're saving less. They keep having less and less money each year. You know, it's really frightening.
So what is the participation of each one of you in the Occupy movement above and beyond this poetry anthology?
I've only been to one of the Occupy Santa Fe happenings, and I'm not sure what my role is, but right now I know it's as a poet and bringing those truths and the images to light the best I can.
I haven't done anything directly, but my wife has gone to some of the Occupy Santa Fe events and feels very strongly about the lack of health care that's going on in the country and how things are just gradually falling apart, and we need to speak up. We can't remain invisible anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. With the whole Occupy movement, it's an amorphous movement that's still somewhat trying to define itself, and I see my role in it as being a speaker, doing things like this, continually writing, and talking to people.
How do you see in general the role of poetry in social movements?
I think poetry's always been a most important, just like any kind of art. You know, when we want to study a culture, we look at their art. And poetry cuts right to the truth, I think. I think it's the most honest form of communication. You know, it's not about being preachy or it's not about the poet. It's about bringing causes and people's lives to life. That's the way I see it.
I think all poetry is political. And poets are observers of the things that are going on around them. And they want to find the way to express the truth, express what they see in as clear a way as they're able to do that so that other people will pay attention and listen.
Yeah, and poets have been doing this for centuries. You know, in our lifetimes, poets have written quite a bit about the environment, environmental issues. After that, another example that I can think of is the Poets Against the War movement that started during the run-up to the Iraq-Afghanistan invasions in 2001, right? Yeah. And
03.
Yeah. And thousands and maybe 100,000 poems got submitted to the Poets Against the War website, and they were ultimately delivered to the White House. Not that
it did any good.
It did some good in some ways, but you know, poets need to continue to speak out on all of these issues.
So the event that's happening tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe here in Santa Fe. What will be happening? The three of you and another poet, Jules Nyquist, will be reading. Will you also read some of the pieces that other poets around the world have written?
Yes, we will. And other people can also read. If other people would like to come, they can read from the book, other poets or anyone else. And there will be an open mic later, and they can read their own work also.
Excellent. What do you see as the potential or your hope for the Occupy movement?
Well, one, definitely to continue spreading the message of inequality, misgovernment spending, potentially. President Obama has clearly gotten the message. His new budget projects taking money away from the Pentagon and putting it towards sustainability, energy sustainability, education, research and development, and maybe jobs. So it's really clear that the movement needs to keep getting these messages out.
Yeah, continuing. Hopefully the Occupy will just keep growing and growing, and people will start to realize that we have power when we can work together. We do. I mean, just what we've seen with the internet and different things, we can spread the word quickly, and there's 99% of us. So,
well, we look forward to seeing you tomorrow at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe, which is on the web at luckybeandowntowncafe.com, and it's in the Sambusco Shopping Center in Santa Fe. Greg Opstad, Michael G. Smith, and Mary Strong Jackson, thanks very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Shirley.